For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in the cave with me, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle, a couple of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to run across. Gentlemen, we're coming up on the 500th anniversary of the launching of the Protestant Reformation. Now, the Protestant Reformation started many years before the founding of America, but it had a profound influence on the founding fathers, on the structure of America as a nation. Now, one of the things that has been kind of pushed aside is, did the Catholics have any real influence in that? And what is the role of Catholicism in the development of America? And is America primarily a Protestant country? Or did the Catholics have, you know, a role in that?
Well, that's a great loaded question.
I was going to say, that's a complex question there. We're going to take a
good
while.
Good thing we only got one. We only got an hour here, Kent. But I'm so glad you raised that question. I mean, here we are at that 500-year anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, sometimes referred to revolt, sometimes revolution. And it's through previous programs here in the Catholic Cave, but also many other Catholic and other historians and theologians and philosophers. We're all taking stock of what happened, why, and what have been sort of the consequences. And then lastly, kind of where do we go from here? And so we're going to do a little bit of that today on today's program, and trying to, so there's so much there, but we're going to try to touch on important, maybe philosophical principles that and developments that happen in this sort of contest of ideas. I think that's a great way to, for us to kind of think about the Reformation from a philosophical standpoint, is that there's a contest of ideas. Some ideas are good ideas, some are bad ideas, some are mixed, and then ideas have consequences, right? That's it's a cliche that holds true.
Right, and you know, we live in a country right now that I think is one of those consequences, if for lack of a better word, of the Protestant Reformation. I mean, America came about because of the ideas that were generated from the Protestant Reformation, not only directly Protestantism. I mean, of the 13 colonies, you know, Maryland was Catholic, but the rest of them were Protestant. Not only is it a Protestant country, but also that the Enlightenment came out of the Protestant Reformation to a great extent. So all of those ideas that came out of the Enlightenment, you can trace those back to the Protestant Reformation, right or wrong, to a certain extent. And so, you know, America itself is in a lot of ways the, you know, I guess, direct sort of descendant of the Reformation and the Reformation ideas, and was founded very much as a Protestant country.
Yeah, I think if you look at the demographics, it is, America is overwhelmingly self-identifies as a Christian nation, as a Protestant Christian, of which Catholics are a part of that, right?
So, right. But, you know, Catholicism, like, barring Maryland, Catholicism came to America as almost an immigrant religion. So, you know, the waves of various immigrants, first German immigrants, and then Irish immigrants, and then Polish immigrants, and then Italian immigrants, all of these waves of Catholics came over and settled, but it was sort of underneath the overlay of those Enlightenment ideas that were very much English Protestant ideas.
Yes. You look at, if you read any of the biographies of the founding fathers, you can see that they were heavily influenced and often explicitly referenced Enlightenment thinkers, especially around their, as it pertained to their understanding political arrangements. So you see influences from John Locke, John Stuart Mill, heavily weighing in on how they see this project called America and how to bring it all together. And you'll see it in our founding documents, whether it's the Declaration of Independence, whether it's the Constitution, and even the amendments, right, often many of them, especially the Bill of Rights, these come right out of Enlightenment thinkers.
Right. And not only that, I think there's some other intellectual trends that come out of the Protestant Reformation that have less to do with religion that set the stage for American independence and the idea of a nation that's founded on the will of the people rather than a monarch. Because what happened right after the Protestant Reformation is you had the 30 Years' War. So you had this massive war between different principalities, different kingdoms. Some had declared they were Catholic. Some had declared they were Lutheran. They fought it out almost to the point of exhaustion. And then you had the Treaty of Westphalia. And with that treaty, you had the emergence of the nation state. So this is a new entity in the history of the world, the nation state. We kind of take it for granted that there's always been nations. But there was a new idea of political arrangement. And that in a lot of ways set the stage for us to declare independence from our king.
Yeah, that's such a critical development that happened. I mean, prior to Europe, you know, what we refer to as Europe today, really was Christendom, right? It was a Christian empire, right, that emerges from the Roman Empire, becomes what? The Holy Roman Empire, right? And then you begin to have, for a variety of different factors, including cultural changes, language, all begin to lend itself towards these things that begin to build up, and then these theological developments, and then eventually you have, as they say, Luther lit the match, but the house was already full of straw, right? So, and we had talked a little bit about that in a previous program. It's also probably better to, or more accurate to refer to as the Protestant Reformations, plural. I know, Kent, that's something that you've studied quite extensively.
Yeah, we've taken a look, especially on our Faith in Action programs over the past few months, at the Reformations, separating them out. And I would have to look back and say that I think probably one of the most influential individuals on American thought as far as the political structure goes would have to be Calvin. Because Calvin, Lutheranism basically was instituted from the top down. The powers that be, the nobility, accepted Lutheranism very early on and took it as a, quote, state religion. Now, along comes Calvin, and Calvin has a little different approach to things. Calvin looks at things and says, well, you know what? That's okay, except for the fact that if your rulers are ungodly men, you don't have to follow them. And so that kind of thought and, you know, that kind of approach, you know, which eventually led to a lot of the Puritanism and those kinds of things, which were prevalent here in the United States, in what would become the United States, led to very much of the Enlightenment thinking and that kind of situation where it's a matter of, you know what, we don't like what the king of England and the Parliament are doing to us. We don't think that's a godly way to treat us. Therefore, we have the right to step away.
Right. And, you know, Calvinism very much set the stage for the separation between Anglican, you know, religion that was faithful to the King of England versus Presbyterianism. And a lot of the founding of America were Presbyterians that came over here. So that mentality and that thought process that, you know, God had ordained certain people to be rulers, others he hadn't. And you know, if it was obvious that the person who was ruling you was not one of the chosen, you didn't have to follow them. You know, that mentality very much permeated, I think, the air in America leading up to our revolution.
I think also, too, it's worth noting that in the United States of America, you have, so you see this in particular throughout the 19th century, and it's still with us today, the development of new Christian denominations, new Christian movements, new foundings of Christian movements and ecclesial communities just sort of explodes here in the United States in terms of there's large numbers of them in a way that doesn't happen anywhere else, because in Europe, you still had a lot of constraints around, you just couldn't be a Jehovah Witness in Berlin. You know what I mean? It's just not, it didn't happen. It didn't happen because the state still would, you know, control the state. There is no separation of church and state. The state's still going to control which religions are permitted. And so if you were of, in the United States, you didn't have those constraints. So you begin to have charismatic and other leaders begin to found things, like, as I meant. So you have, well, what's one of the ones? Well, think of like Mormonism, right? The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You have John Smith, but you have the Seventh-day Adventists. You have the Jehovah Witnesses. I mean, there's legion, right?
Right.
Number of different Protestant denominations that start here in America because of that those conditions on the ground.
Well, a lot of those conditions were just simply the fact that America was this great, big, giant, vast wilderness. So a lot of these denominations and groups started not because they weren't persecuted and not because they were tolerated, but because they were kicked out of communities and they had somewhere to go. So
well,
I mean,
they could flee.
They could flee, exactly. So, you know, you had the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And Roger Williams was, you know, more or less expelled from that colony, went down, founded Rhode Island, and he was the beginning of the Baptists. So all of the Baptists then, you know, take their roots, and, you know, once again, there's a splintering that goes on. And each of them, in some ways, they were kind of kicked out of their communities to form new communities. And, you know, you look at the Mormons also. I mean, the Mormons weren't tolerated. They were kicked out and pushed out and forced out into the wilderness. So you've got sort of that trajectory of, you know, basically by revolt, therefore colonizing. So you have this sort of colonizing aspect of Protestantism
that,
going on.
That is true. That really does kind of animate the movement of that. But they weren't arrested, though. It wasn't illegal. And that would be a difference, maybe, because they weren't thrown in jail.
Right. Right,
they were
right.
Chased out of town, yeah. Like John Smith, right? That's why they wound up in Utah.
So,
because polygamy was rejected by the Maine.
They were persecuted, but not prosecuted.
Correct. Right. Which is what often happens. And so you have here in America, then, You begin to have a whole wide variety, and we still have it today. There's something like 20 or 30,000 different kinds of flavors of Christianity here in the United States.
Right, and we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about one of the reasons why that is, and that's because of the concept of religious toleration.
And we'll be back in just a couple minutes on The Catholic Cave.
Catholic Radio. Changing hearts and minds.
Found your station about a month ago, and I have never turned my station off since I found you. Every time something I take offense to comes up, y'all answer it almost immediately as to make me see through with prayer. Thank you so much for saving me.
You can help keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air by making a donation at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we are talking about the aftermath of the Protestant Reformation, and particularly how it led to the founding of America. America is very much a Protestant nation, and a lot of our ideas, a lot of our ideals come from Protestantism, Protestant ideas, and not always are they necessarily compatible with Catholicism. And so one of the big things we're just talking about is this splintering that Protestantism tended to lead itself toward, particularly in America. And that's because of religious toleration. Now, that's an idea we take for granted. You know, we look at it, our church is very much a promoter of religious toleration. You know, basically, you know, we kind of understand that people have to come to the truth through their own will. People can't be forced to.
Or ought not to be.
Or ought not to be, exactly. But this is a question that it was very controversial for a long time. It's not something that was always taken for granted by any stretch. And so I want to raise this question a little bit. We live in a world of religious plurality. We live in a world of religious toleration that came out of the Protestant Reformation in really in some ways was a pushback against Catholicism. To what extent is there a right to be wrong? Because that's ultimately what you're talking about when you're talking about religious plurality. There's only one truth. And so when you're talking about tolerating other religions, what you're ultimately talking about is tolerating error. So to what extent is there a right to be wrong?
Well, it makes me think of the saying, error has no rights.
Right, exactly.
Error
yeah.
has no rights. So,
well, not only that, but if you're in the position of a civil magistrate and you see people going astray, we certainly today don't think it's within the realm of the magistrate's responsibility to straighten people out and put them on the straight and narrow. But that's a very contemporary ideas.
Well, there are impulses these days around certain kinds of speech.
Right.
They
yeah.
can't be tolerated.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And you can suffer violence
right.
now on campuses, right?
Yeah.
If you don't toe a certain political line or subscribe to a certain ideology. And we'll get there. So I'm racing ahead there. But I would say, when I say error has no rights, I think of there's a I'll paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, but Venerable Archbishop Fulton Sheen has a great quote around error, and it basically says error has no rights, and that the problem with America, in contemporary America as he saw it, is that we're too tolerant. In other words, we've got to strike this balance between the idea and positions that people hold and the person themselves. So I would say that the right balance that's to be struck is we need to tolerate and respect and affirm the dignity of every human being in and of themselves. But we also ought to vigorously pursue the truth and move from falsehood, misunderstanding, darkness into the light, into the truth of things, into the way things really are. That's what we ought to be. And that should be everyone's most fundamental commitment ought to be to the truth of things. And so we have to tolerate different positions, but it doesn't mean we just leave someone in error if we know them to be in error. In other words, it's not an act of charity for me, Mark, if I were to hear you affirm, 2 + 2 = 5, I shouldn't just sit back and say, that's just how he sees it. I think it's 4, and I'm convinced it's 4. But I also ought not to, what I ought to do is I ought to engage you with facts, evidence, persuasive arguments, and such, and try to win you over to the truth of things. And we ought to be able to discuss it. This is the foundation, by the way. I'll tie back to the Bill of Rights. This is the foundation for free speech. The reason why we have a right to free speech, it's recognized by the state, it's not granted, is because the only way for us together to pursue and obtain the truth is if we can truly share with each other authentically what our positions are, what we're truly thinking, and understanding that there will be disagreement, but I ought not to pick up my sword to settle the matter with you, right?
Right. No forced conversions. But there's two things that are part of that thought process. First off, I think it's important to point out that in the founding of America and this idea of religious freedom, the idea was not necessarily religious plurality. I think what the founding fathers saw was a winnowing out of bad ideas. They talked about a marketplace of ideas where you would have a vigorous discussion and eventually only the truth would win out. So rather than this, explosion of different points of view and, I have to respect your point of view and you have to respect my point of view and we all get along, I think they foresaw a winnowing out where we would move closer towards unanimity and closer to, one viewpoint that was the truth.
That's a great point. I just want to underscore that. Mark, you hit the nail on the head. That's the assumption that the truth would win out. But I don't think that's what's happening.
No, that's not what's happening. No, what we wound up is rather than a marketplace of ideas, we wound up with a battle place of ideas. And rather than a vigorous discussion, we just have the ability to try to shout each other down and try to force our viewpoint on other people without a discussion around rationality. Rationality, though, is the other assumption. And that's really what I really wanted to get. And I think this is a question that we as Catholics really need to wrestle with and talk through. When you say that there is a marketplace of ideas and eventually the truth is going to win out, what you're ultimately saying is reason is situated above revelation. That the truth is something that we can come to through rational debate, and it will eventually winnow out and sort of, moderate all of the claims of divine revelation and all of the claims of, we received this, in a miraculous way from our predecessors, that will be sort of evened out through a process of reason. And so basically when you say there's a marketplace of ideas, we need this vigorous discussion, etc., to get to the truth, what you're saying is ultimately reason, not revelation, is the truth.
I think that's the error.
Well, I think it is an error. Oh, most certainly that's an error. But it's an error. It's an error.
But it's a you did articulate very well what that's a huge problem that we're living with, right? And I think the person that comes to mind who maybe addressed it best was Blessed John Henry Newman. He called reason would go wild, and so in other words. He affirmed our faculty of reason as really being able to deliver us to the truth. However, he also noticed in our fallen human nature, which we can't lose sight of, that we also can go wildly off course with it. Right? There are a lot of brilliant people, Mark, who hold professorships at highly acclaimed and astute and elite universities here in America and abroad, and have reached wildly wrong conclusions about the nature of human beings, and they're atheists and all sorts of things, right? So reason itself isn't going to be enough to deliver us to the truth.
I am shocked that there are people that their error, that their reason leads them astray. I mean, they're just absolutely shocked.
Right. But that's the over. So this is one of those, I would say, one of these really interesting paradoxes about reason. The one of the main projects, as I understand, of the Enlightenment was to sort of, as you said, sort of kick revelation out of the divine revelation's messy, lots of different things, lots of different ways to interpret it. So let's just get rid of that and let's just focus on reason itself and make the man, the measure of all things. And it's through what? Pure reason, sounds like Kant,
right?
That we'll be able to really get at the truth of things. And this is the modern scientific, secular scientific project, right? We're just going to deal with facts and evidence, right? None of that cloudy hocus pocus from religion. Well, what happens is, though, you still wind up with this whole quite pluralistic and diverse set of things that are what? Contradictory. Of people who are supposedly just using reason, but they're reaching completely contradictory, not just different, I mean contradictory positions. Right. And as a result, we need divine revelation to keep us on course.
Yeah, one of the reactions to this process that came out of the Enlightenment was a almost empirical test of the truth of religion. And it was based on morality, which I find interesting. So you read John Locke, and you read John Locke's essays on religious experience, for instance.
Mills.
Right. Or Mills, but more Locke than Mill. What he lays out is a series of rational, empirical, almost scientific tests to test if the moral character that is coming out of this religion is, something that's good, or if, these claims of revelation, etc., are leading people off of the moral path. You know, then obviously it's false. And
right.
Yeah.
As he sees it.
Right. As he sees it. And, you know, I think one of the great sort of counters to that came out of Kierkegaard, where Kierkegaard, you know, threw out in fear and trembling, well, what about Abraham? You know, you've got Abraham being told by God to go murder his son. Obviously, if you look at this from a moral standpoint, this is going to fail any sort of moral test, right? But yet there it is. But, you know, I think we carry with us today that, that sort of moral empirical test of religious truth. And in some ways it is valid. In some ways it is good. I mean, true religion is not going to lead people to do something that's truly immoral. Even in the case of Abraham, God intervened and stopped him from doing something that the rest of us would obviously see as horrendously immoral. There's something sort of lacking with that test of a moral view of religion, that the religion is always necessarily going to lead to a moral person.
Well, I think what tying that back into sort of this American project, I think what I'm seeing is a couple of quick things. One is we no longer have, and we haven't for some time now. Kind of as a people, we don't seem to have the intestinal fortitude to do the heavy lifting required to resolve these great differences. And so this, I think, fuels further splintering and fracturing within the society around this whole contest of ideas, right? And so rather than us figuring out, doing the heavy lifting of trying to work through our differing positions towards the truth of things, we instead abandon that project and simply insulate ourselves. We stop talking to one another and just sort of establish a new sphere in which I find companions that affirm the same ideas that I have. And I think you see that, and I think we've been on that trajectory for 150 years. And I think the problems that we're seeing on campuses with these violent reactions to disagreement is something that we're going to pick up after the break.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave with me is my trusty companion and cave dweller, Mark Tuttle, and our sidekick, Kent Blanford. Today, we are talking about the Protestant Reformation. Mark is making a face at me like I demoted him or something. I don't
know. Sidekick?
Oh, yeah, forget. Yeah. Yeah, he's more than that, but...
I control your microphone.
That's right. Right. Well, I always think of the Peter Sellers character, you know, Inspector Clouseau and his trusty companion, Cato.
Cato, yeah.
Constantly popping out of the closet with his karate moves to keep him on his toes. I love that.
Cato was actually the brains of the operation,
right,
too.
Exactly. As is so often the case, right? It's the folks behind the scenes that really are the ones that matter. So let me pick up going back to this college campus, and what I think was going on is I wanted to touch on was this phenomenon that we're seeing a lot in the news of these college students acting, using a lot of, intimidation, threats of violence, actual violence against those to whom they disagree. And there's all kinds of stuff popping up on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, all that kind of stuff, social media and regular media too. And I think that goes back to this idea that or this trajectory that we've been on here of a institutionalized kind of intolerance under the battle flag of tolerance and diversity and inclusion, as long as you agree with me. And so I think where that's going to lead us, though, is point us to the second problem that I want to bring up, Mark, and I want to get your take on this is, you know, when we think about this project of the Enlightenment, putting so much emphasis on reason and the individual has led us into kind of a domain in which we have, I would say, the two dominant philosophical themes now are radical autonomy and consent. So as long as you have those two things present, kind of anything goes, you know, as long as, but what do you think is going on in terms of this tension that maybe is arising between community, the radical autonomy that we're seeing, ideas of consent?
Right. I mean, it goes back to the concept we were talking about, where you have a marketplace of ideas. You have this discussion back and forth between differing viewpoints that eventually will winnow down and we'll get to the truth, because the bad ideas will just sort of be weeded out. Well, we were talking about a moral test of the truth that prevailed in the Enlightenment, that, you know, well, bad religion leads to bad behavior. And so there was a kind of almost a moral test. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, then where do our moral sentiments come from to determine that? And, you know, the idea then is that it comes from the communities that we live in. And this, I think, goes back to a fundamental tension that we see in the United States. And Patrick Deneen has kind of pointed to this, that on the one hand, you have this understanding of humanity as a political animal, Aristotle's political animal, that we come together to form communities. Those communities have standards, they have rules that come out of the political formation of them. The small C constitutions, all those little institutions and little platoons that make up civil society.
Right.
So you have that on one hand, but then you have the Enlightenment project. The Enlightenment project of trying to base everything on reason and coming up with a scientific, reasoned out model of the truth. It creates a tremendous amount of tension. And what I think has ultimately happened is you see this Enlightenment idea of radical autonomy and somehow having access to the truth with a great big T, unmoored from human society, unmoored from human experience, unmoored from sort of the practical science of living. All of that is sort of this abstract understanding of what's truth. There's no way to take care of differences.
Yeah.
And so what basically then is my opinion, put it against your opinion, and whichever one of us can either generate the most friends to back us up or carry the biggest clubs or wield the most amount of money wins.
And that's the will to power.
That's
right?
The will to power. Right. Yeah,
that's where we end up.
Yeah. And McIntyre characterized the situation as Aristotle, i.e. the ethics of community, the ethics of shared experience, the ethics of sort of a practical discussion of, well, where should we all go? Versus Nietzsche, which is this battlefield of ideas of, well, I've got my idea, you've got your idea, he's got his idea, and we're just going to figure out which one of us is strong enough to impose our will.
Yeah, everyone has a perspective, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's kind of where we are, and that in some ways is a natural offshoot of this unmooring of reason from revelation and from religion.
Right. I know... In studying ethics, a way for us to get at that principle that you're talking about is that there's really kind of a hierarchy, right? When it comes to, say, laws, ethics, as it pertains to, say, laws being what, by the term law, I mean ordinances of reason, right? That are directing us towards the common good. And we always think about, and this is really exemplified from an American standpoint in Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., where he brings up natural law and this idea of just and unjust laws, right? Which is a certain kind of ethics, right? He's pointing to racial segregation and other Jim Crow laws as being fundamentally unethical, immoral, and unjust. And so the question arises, though, how do we know it's unjust? What's the measure? Well, there's a hierarchy. There's that which dwells in the human plane, such as human reason. But then the next rung up the ladder, if you will, is the natural law, right? The natural, right. That which we can obtain, again, through reason, but grounded in what? Human nature. But then above that, you have what? Divine law, which is that which has been revealed to us. And then even above that, you have the eternal law, that which what governs the cosmos. So you have this these sort of four rungs on a ladder. Each can serve as a corrective to the rung below it, so that if we come to a wrong conclusion, if we're in error around using human reason, leads us into error, like passing laws that are discriminatory, unjustly discriminatory, then we can appeal to the next rung up, or two or three rungs up, as the corrective to it. And this is where I would point to something like abortion is in a lot of ways emblematic of this Enlightenment project gone crazy wrong.
Right. And you know, we've been talking about America as sort of the product of the Protestant Reformation. This is a Protestant country. It was very much founded by Protestants, founded on Protestant ideals. Whether those ideals were directly the religious ideas of the Puritans and other settlers coming over, or whether they were the Enlightenment ideals that eventually went into our founding documents, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the way we constituted it. In so many ways, this is a Protestant country. And Catholics came over as immigrants, and over the years, what Catholicism has played in the United States is sort of that role of conscience. In a lot of ways, we've played that role that you were laying mm-hmm. out of that appeal to natural law and that corrective when reason goes amok and comes up with just craziness like abortion and other things like that. The Catholic Church in America has been to a certain extent the conscience that says, whoa, we're going way out of bounds here. Is that a fair characterization to a certain extent of what's happened with the role of Catholicism in America?
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, the abortion battle is a great example of where the Catholic Church has held firm, where many, many others have folded. I think you can look at religious liberty as another arena. I would roll the clock back 100 years. Who was, you know, what group was the greatest foe to the KKK? Well, it was the Catholic Church, and Catholic right. Americans were the ones that pushed back hardest against the KKK.
Right. And other social injustices too. You know, there a lot of American history is labor relations and the struggle between those people who are
being labor and the capitalists.
Labor and the capitalists.
When it's unjust.
Or you go down south and go a little bit further, you know, the slaves versus the plantation right. owners. But this role of respecting the human dignity of each individual, of you know, making sure that each person is provided for by society, etc., was very much you know, the Catholic Church. More particularly, Pope Leo XIII with Rerum Novarum stepping in to once again kind of say, wait a second, reason, pure capitalism, you know, sort of the I guess, sort of results of this idea of radical autonomy is leading to massive social injustice, and we need to slow down and put the brakes on it.
Well, I think that's one of the main sources for anti-Catholicism has been that these pesky Catholics won't fall in line. They seem to keep listening to this thing called the magisterium. They keep listening to their bishops. They listen to and read papal documents, and they fall in line. And this has fed into a kind of a virulent anti-Catholicism, because Catholics are seen as being under the sway of foreign powers and therefore not fully American in that sense, because they're listening to those who are not native to our country.
I think it's also an important reason for us Catholics to understand that the Catholic Church has been very resistant, particularly in America, probably more so in America than other countries, to engage in politics, to get behind one party or the other, even though, you know, we may look at it as individuals and say, it's very clear that party X is really the party that ought to be the Catholic party, and we should all line up as Catholics and get behind party X. The bishops have always been very reluctant, and I would say wisely so to a certain extent, to do that, to line up behind one party or the other, even if it looks like, at least at this point in history, it's the good party versus the evil party.
Right. Yeah, it can't be, for Catholics, it just simply can't be reduced to mere party affiliations. The parties themselves change. No, Catholics, we should live out our Catholic faith, a strong Catholic identity, not just in the political sphere, through what? Through the teachings of the Church and the principles that we hold. And that applies not just to the political realm, but every sphere that we are in. And this is why battles over conscience rights are so critical as well. And with that, we're going to take our last break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the Protestant influence on the founding of America, kind of where we're at now. And as Catholics, how might we understand our role in American society?
And you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, with our wonderful producer that is doing a great job.
Notice how you upgraded him.
Oh, I know.
How I introduced him.
I know. You insulted him last time, so now...
He's terribly offended.
Exactly.
He's melting.
So Mark sees my hand on the button.
That's right. You do have the nuclear option.
Right, so we have to...
Mic off.
We have to pacify Kent.
Right. Here in the Catholic Cave, it used to be Timothy O'Donnell.
Right.
Currently.
Well, we've been talking about Protestantism. We've been talking about America, how America was very much founded as a Protestant country. And leading into the break, we were talking about this notion of tolerance. And during the break, Kent brought up, I think, a great point that Catholicism has tended to be tolerant, but has never gone that extra step of being accepting. So, you know, we see errors, we're tolerant of other people that disagree with us, but we've always drawn the line at being forced, I think, to affirm and accept people that are obviously wrong.
All right. I want to share with our audience this this quote from, it was Monsignor Fulton Sheen at the time. From 1931, he said, quote, "America, it is said, is suffering from intolerance. It is not. It is suffering from tolerance. Tolerance of right and wrong, truth and error, virtue and evil, Christ and chaos. Our country is not nearly so overrun with the bigoted as it is overrun with the broad-minded. Tolerance is an attitude of reasoned patience towards evil, a forbearance that restrains us from showing anger or inflicting punishment. Tolerance applies only to persons, never to truth. Tolerance applies to the erring, intolerance to the error. Architects are as intolerant about sand as foundations for skyscrapers as doctors are intolerant about germs in the laboratory. Tolerance does not apply to truth or principles. About these things, we must be intolerant. And for this kind of intolerance, so much needed to rouse us from our sentimental gush, I make a plea. Intolerance of this kind is the foundation of all stability, unquote. So Monsignor Fulton Sheen there, I think, is pointing out an incredibly important distinction that we need to make between persons and their ideas. And that when it comes to tolerance, which we've been talking about, and tolerance is a great virtue, but it's not the only virtue, and it's not maybe the highest virtue that we can attain. But I do think it's helpful in that quote that he's pointing out that we ought not to tolerate evil, injustices, error themselves, but we ought to be what? Exercise a kind of forbearance, a kind of patience with people as we help them or ourselves move and obtain more and more of the truth of things.
Right. You know, you started by saying that was in 1931, you know, on the airwaves of the radio. And you think about what was going on in the country right then. I mean, you had segregation.
In the world.
And in the world, too, right. Yeah. But you had segregation going on in the South. Huge injustices just across the board to a great extent. You know, the Great Depression had started with the stock market crashing in 1929. And so you had the whole blame game of, you know, who was responsible for that. You know, obviously, this idea that, you know, we need to tolerate persons and individuals, but not bad ideas, had a certain resonance. Probably, I guess, more of a resonance then than it did today.
Yeah, and, you know, there were a lot of ideas that were floating around back then, some of which are still with us now. I mean, you think of 1930, right around that time, you're really beginning to have things like eugenics, abortion, contraception, right? Contraception begins to become mainstream or acceptable by the many of the larger Protestant religious denominations here in the United States. There's also a kind of, at that time too, a kind of fascination with the Soviet Union and its project there, and sort of its promise of utopia for workers, which has a certain, you know, when our own economy is, you know, in quite a bit of turmoil, alternatives begin to look really attractive.
Right, right. Well, he also brought up something else in that. And he said, you know, just like an architect is going to be highly intolerant of the idea of sand as a foundation for a skyscraper. And
the fact that he used skyscraper too. We don't use that term anymore.
But also that, you know, a doctor is going to be highly intolerant of germs. These are what St. Thomas Aquinas would have called practical sciences. They're sciences that are directed towards a definite goal that, you know, it's a step-by-step process of, well, how do we build a big building? And how do we, you know, make sure that there's a healthy person or a healthy population? That differs quite a bit from what we're talking about when we're talking about toleration of error, which is a theoretical thing, right? So you've got the theoretical sciences and sort of theoretical knowledge, and there you have a lot of error, and you've got a lot of room for error and a lot of discussion. But when you've got a practical science, there's no room for error. You can't have mistakes if you're directing your actions towards some sort of goal. And so I think when it comes to talking about tolerance and truth, that's almost a category mistake that we often make when it comes to morality.
It is. And I think it's what makes sorting out ethics and morality so problematic in our current setting. When we deal in the when we're trying to wrestle with or deal with the realm of abstract ideas, or as like Mortimer Ann would talk about, the great ideas. So trying to define things like what is truth, what is justice, what is the beautiful, things we brought up on this program in the past, you know, these are these sort of abstract ideas and ideals. It becomes, as you said, kind of there's sort of a theoretical component to it, but there's lots of room. These are entire spheres. These ideas are entire spheres worthy of investigation. And so there's lots of room, and there's lots of room for disagreement, especially initially. And I think when it comes to issues of ethics, morality, we don't seem to in much of the cultural setting, we don't seem that interested in working towards common understandings. It's much more of a you do your thing and I'll do mine.
Right. And in America, with this idea of plurality, with this idea of religious freedom, tolerance that we've been talking about, is it possible for us to have directed action towards a common goal, classical morality, where, you know, really morality and ethics were a practical science. They were directed towards a notion of human flourishing. Is that even possible in today's day and age?
Well, I think that's a great place to begin, would be for us as a society to, think about, well, what is our purpose? What is the purpose of America? I mean, two things pop into mind just quickly. One is when you think about, I think what would have been assumed throughout most of history is that, you know, it's perpetuating one's culture, one's society is sort of a prima facie good. But I think, though, with this, we're sort of cut off on purpose from future generations, and to an extent we haven't been before. And by that I mean, if you look at, and here I'll zoom out a little bit, if you look at the heads of state of major European countries, they're childless.
Right. Yeah.
And Europe often is sort of a foreshadowing of where America may tend to go. It's not obviously it has to go there, but when you think of, I'm looking, you know, the heads of state for Great Britain, France, Germany, they're all childless, right? And so that without having children yourself or having that direct connection, would seem to be a kind of weakening towards one's posture towards the future and future generations if one really doesn't have any skin in the game.
Right. You know, there was a lot of discussion around the last election of the American dream. You know, what constitutes the American dream? And it's usually, you know, something about owning a house and owning, you know,
a middle-class kind of lifestyle.
Right, exactly. But I think if you went back even 15, 20 years, having a better life for your children than what I'm enjoying now. So my children having a better life than I have has always been part of that American dream. And that wasn't even mentioned. That wasn't even brought up.
Yeah, it's not even brought up. People don't even talk about it.
Right.
I want this to be a better country, or I want my children to have more opportunity. And it's not that parents don't want that. It's just that seems to have dropped out of the national conversation.
Right. And the national conversation, and not only in America, but in Europe too, is
and about, Europe first, I would say.
It's about the here and now. It's about what.
Yeah, maximizing my, I would say it's pretty hedonistic too, sort of maximizing my pleasurable experiences and minimizing those things that I find unpleasant or undesirable.
Now, is that the logical conclusion of these Enlightenment ideals that we've been talking about this show, that America was founded on? Was America almost from the beginning
destined
to become, you know, kind of the hedonistic caricature of what America is that you hear often?
Well, I think in my reading of, like, you mentioned Patrick Deneen, who's a professor up at Notre Dame, has been on the show. We need to have him back again real soon.
Yeah, we can ask him that question.
Exactly. And I think he would say, and I would tend to agree, yeah, this is sort of this atomization of society into tiny little particles of individuals disconnected from each other is the result of this founding project of this American liberalism.
So what can we do as Catholics? I mean, how can we push back against this atomization? How can we push back against kind of the hedonism that, if we're saying that's what America was founded to become, how do we push back as Catholics?
Well, I think there's a few strategies. One, first and foremost, is obviously we have to pray, take advantage of the sacraments, have a strong Catholic identity, I guess would be the first and foremost. It's growing in holiness and virtue. There's a lot of other things that we don't have time to get to today because we're almost out of time.
We only have about 45 seconds. What do you have to say?
I think we will invite our listeners back next week to hear us continue this discussion of how should Catholics react to a hedonistic world.
And with that, we'll wrap it up for this week. You've been listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. For Mark Tuttle, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.